Welcome to our second, actually it's our third podcast, because our first podcast with Carmen on Lawyering Up was two volumes. We had so much fun with them. I'm Ed Cirambulli, and today my good friend Jerry Ferrantino's here, Alex Russin from Fellerman and Cirambulli's here, and our good friend John Hakem is here. And this is exciting for me because today I get to talk to two guys that are, you know, really at the forefront of criminal law in Luzerne County. John being with Conflicts Council in the Public Defender's Office, Jared being with the DA's office, and basically Alex and I knowing nothing about criminal law, you know, hope we're going to learn something as well.
You guys are going to learn an incredible amount today from John. It's great to be back on our second show. We didn't get canceled after the pilot. That's always a good sign.
That is definitely a good sign. I want to ask you guys a question. And really the first question I have is, you know, you guys have been doing this now for about a decade, a little bit over a decade. Actually, more than a decade.
I don't want to date myself. I've been doing it more than a decade for sure.
Well, John, I mean, you do have quite. You look like Santa Claus with the white beard. So
it's getting there.
But you know, my first question to you guys is: over the course of the last, you know, let's just leave it the last decade. Like, what have you guys noticed about what is going on in the county in terms of, you know, criminal law and how things have changed? But you know, in your job, John, and your job, Jared. That's what I want to know. Like, what's going on? Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? Are things, you know, what's going on? What's going on here?
I think we've been fairly consistent in the fascinating cases department for many, many years. And John will tell you, Luzerne County has been so exposed because of some of the high profile, particularly murders, John.
You would agree.
We've had, you could go back to the Banks case in 1983. We had Larry Leona Cottom, the couple that starved their child during a religious fast. We had the Glenn Wolsifer and Betty Wolsifer killing in the 90s. That prosecution was in the 90s, up through the Tooley and Stubbs prosecutions, and then ultimately with the Hugo Selinsky prosecution in 2015.
You know a little bit about the
A little bit about that one, yes. So Luzerne County, on both sides, prosecution and defense, have been, we're not pikers up here.
Yeah.
We have been exposed to tremendously challenging, cutting-edge cases, and continue to be. So John and I have had many times front-row seats and beyond front-row seats, backstage passes too, to some of these large-scale prosecutions. And that has been consistent. What's changed, I think, is the expectation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, Jared, you're right. I think that obviously we have a lot of interesting cases here. It's funny, people always say the one thing that our area is generally known for is never anything good. It's, you know, the Agnes flood and, like you mentioned, George Banks. The opioid crisis were a hotbed for it. I think you're correct in that the things that have been changing are not so much those cases, but just the technology and the coverage of true crime podcasts, true crime TV shows, true crime movies, Making a Murderer, all that stuff. People kind of know or have an expectation now of these super high-tech crime scenes. And again, in some of the homicides that Jared's been a part of, and that really actually exists, the real disappointment comes, I think, if you talk to jurors after trial, it's not a homicide or something of that nature. They expect everything is going to be like CSI Miami.
Oh, they expect everything. And listen, the case should be solved within 1 hour.
Oh, yeah.
Including commercial breaks.
Exactly.
And it's solved and prosecuted.
Yeah, and, it's, you know, they're looking for DNA evidence and everything. If there's a video, because on every show on TV, there's a video of the crime happening. And then I'll have defendants say to me, there's no video of me doing it. I'm like, there weren't any videos in the 1800s either. And I'm pretty sure there were people in jail back then. I mean, you don't need a video. It would make Jarrett's job a lot easier if they had you on
video. If we
video.
Had the right guy.
Yeah.
But I think, too, like, a lot of what we're seeing is an educated public. So people come in not only with an expectation, but a lot of good knowledge and a lot of bad knowledge. One of the things people ask me about all the time, these false confessions. Why would somebody confess to a crime they didn't commit? That's a phenomenon in a lot of people.
Right.
But let's start with this premise right here, John. And I think you can agree with me. Most people that get arrested are guilty 99.9% of the time
of something.
We got the right guy or gal, typically. So, which makes John's job challenging if he's going for an acquittal. But we have certain protections in the law. Before we even get there, we're supposed to have honored certain levels of suspicion, certain levels of lawful authority to
well,
make
that. Sounds like let me let me just statistics.
Yeah. Right. Well, I will agree with
you. So you know, Jared mentioned though, and I want to ask. He mentioned about like your job. So you know, for people who aren't lawyers and might not necessarily understand like what a public defender is. And when you get a public defender, right. Tell us, like, what do you do? I mean, other than the fact that you're handsome and smart and cool, what is it that you should have been?
With those attributes, you should have been in the DA's office.
I could not tell who he was looking at, but I'll assume that question was for me. But, well, my title at this point is Attorney Administrator of the Department of Conflict Counsel. I don't want to bore people with that too much, but it's basically without cost, indigent defense for criminal defendants, similar to a public defender's office. So to answer the general question, someone gets arrested, they are guaranteed the right to a lawyer. This is the whole, you get arrested on TV. The other thing that the quote unquote educated public knows is that you have a right to a lawyer and you don't have to say anything.
Where does that right come from?
Well, there are Miranda rights, which is your right to remain silent. The right to counsel is from the Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which is basically repeated in the PA Constitution. And there was a very famous case called Gideon versus Wainwright, which solidifies a defendant's right to counsel, even if they cannot afford one.
So why? I mean, why is it so important in the United States? Because which is different than, you know, pretty much every other country in the world. Why is it so important for the defendant to immediately have the right to an attorney from the moment that they're arrested?
Well, it's partly because of the nation we live in and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights that we have. You know, everyone is a free person within the confines of the law. Everyone is presumed to be innocent. So at the point when you are arrested or accused of a crime, and again, Jared had said 99.9% of the people are guilty. I'll say most of the people that are arrested probably did something that might have warranted them getting arrested unless they got the wrong person. Guilty is a legal term, so they...
Well, there's levels of guilt, too. We can expand on that.
Again, you're charging with a particular crime, so whether they're guilty or not depends, but I digress. But you are presumed to be innocent. And in a country that values liberty and freedom, one of their habeas corpus and things, you have a right to know what you're accused of. You have a right to confront your accuser. This is not a country like some places in the world where you just get snatched up off the street by the government and thrown in jail. Your family doesn't know where you are or what you allegedly did wrong. In this country, we value individual rights. So you have a right to be told, this is what we say you did. Right. And we will presume that you are innocent and then it's the state's responsibility and duty and burden to prove that you did what we're accusing you of, which is a tremendous, tremendous burden for an individual to fight against, first of all, a very smart prosecutor like Jared, but also just...
Oh, I thought you were talking about Alex. Yeah,
he's very smart, but not a prosecutor. But plus the entire power and finances of the state are coming down on this individual.
In elementary school, we learn about checks and balances.
Right.
Isn't your job a major check on the power of the judiciary and the power of police and the state from coming down and snatching somebody out of their house? See, every time the founding fathers granted certain rights, they tried their best to have that check. And John, by virtue of the Sixth Amendment, is that check for individuals charged.
And going back to the
individuals that can't afford their own lawyer.
Exactly. If you can afford a lawyer, you have the right to the lawyer you're choosing. If you cannot afford one, and there is a test to determine whether or not you are indigent, meaning can't afford it. And if so, you would then be provided with an attorney free of cost. But, you know, going back to that English tradition of the law that we have, part of the reason many of the amendments are in the Constitution are because of that. If you recall, like the Fourth Amendment, the right against search and seizure, comes from exactly the Revolutionary War, because the British Army would come in, just kick down your door, search your house for no reason, because they figure, well, if we hit all the houses, eventually we'll find these rebels.
again, I don't want to get political, but seeing a lot of what's going on now after the Patriot Act and everything, you kind of chip away on individual liberties, and people under that guise of we want safety. Like, how much of your liberty are you going to give up for safety? And we need safety, absolutely. But, you know, be careful about giving up your rights, because at the point when they say, well, I didn't do anything, I have nothing to be afraid of. I don't think any of us in this room are criminals, but I don't know that any of us want. I don't know any of us want like the FBI coming through your house, going through everything. Right. I mean, who wants?
I'm going through your phone right now. But so one of the things too, and people have asked me, and I'm sure they've asked you a thousand times, how could you or how could someone defend people charged with a crime or people like this? And the reality is, from my perspective as a prosecutor, we need to ensure that there's a level playing field. We need to ensure that constitutional protections are protected because, number one, we are residents of this community. We want to make sure we're not denying people's rights. And two, we want to preserve the integrity of our cases, too. I always tell people the Rocky movies would be horrible if there was just Rocky in the ring. There's got to be an adversary. There's got to be somebody who's questioning and challenging and combating what you're doing. And that's the role John plays. And John is one of, you know, you'll hear people, public defenders, and John will agree, I think, get a bad rap oftentimes too. There's the critical clients that they deal with and the critical public. I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt, the finest attorneys that I've gone against and had the pleasure and honor of going against, other than Edward and Alex, is public defenders like John, like the late Bill Russo, like Alex's dad, Basil Russin, guys like Al Flora, people, Tim Fanning. These are individuals that in the private sector really draw a significant amount of money through private clients and have, there are indigent clients that have the benefit of their service. And I can tell you this, from John to the folks that I listed, you can't tell the difference who's paying their bill when they're in that court, because that right is so important to them. And it's as equally important to us, because we need to have and ensure that there's a level playing
field. One of the things I always, you mentioned, you know, I have the luxury of having a father who was in that industry. And
was one of the best, by the way.
Yeah, don't tell him that. But one of the things that
he'll agree. He'll agree.
I won't, but I'm growing up, I remember being a teenager and reading about these people in the paper, you know, rapists, murderers, and my dad's defending them and being like, how on God's green earth can you defend these people? And it's not just every person has a right, but I remember it was actually Billy Russo who told me, you're not just defending this person, you're defending the next person that comes down who maybe this person is guilty, but that next person's not. And everything you're doing for this person could be precedential for that next person.
Very true.
So it's one of those things that I think it's easy to forget when you're in the public and you don't kind of think things through as you're looking at this one thing individually. We need to realize and especially in the legal system, and we all know it, one thing here, it doesn't matter where you are, has a domino effect on every other thing falling after it.
There's lots of shades of gray.
Right. And to follow up on what Jarrett was saying, one, I agree. The public defenders do get a bad rap, whether they're conflict counsel or actual public defenders, they're free, so they're not worth anything, or they all work for the state. You have to flip the lid.
Well, yeah, we should mention.
We'll edit that out in post. We were lucky enough. This is
fantastic. We're at the best cigar pub in Hazleton in their conference room. This place is fantastic.
Yeah, it's in the Can-Do Industrial Park in Drums. It's actually not even open to the public yet. They were kind enough to let us animals come in and take over. But there's a cigar shop. There's a bar restaurant. There's a pub. There's this beautiful conference room.
We're literally in like the back of a smoky room, type thing. And I have a segue on that, because one of the things that I want to know from you guys is, and we hear about it all the time, like, this person, the DA cut a deal with this guy. And, in your office, John, it's like, this person is going to give testimony against another person. And how do you guys approach stuff like that? Because I would imagine both from the prosecution standpoint and the defense standpoint that these are issues that become very complex, that, like the people that you're going to be relying upon in your case are you know, relatively unsavory people. And so how do you decide who's getting a deal, who's not getting a deal? And, you know, for you, Jared, and then you, John, I mean, how do you decide, you know, from a defense standpoint, how do you decide, like, well, we're going to, you know, we're going to attack this person's credibility? Where's the where's
so that's
the line?
That's a it's a great question, and it's a big decision that gets made now in the context of a large scale homicide, let's say, where you have many individuals involved. You cannot. And there's a quote I don't know who it's attributable to, but you can't cast.
Well, attribute it to Alex.
You cannot.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
You can't cast your play in hell and expect angels. So you have.
That's a good one.
Let's just say you have.
Nice job, Alex.
Two or three I'm like defendants, so who were present at a killing, for example, and there is no videotape evidence. You have forensic evidence and some other documentary evidence. You need to cut a deal with someone, provided someone's willing to do it. And you evaluate your case. You approach the counsel. I've had that conversation with John. I've approached John and say, I want to talk with your client. And then you bring an offer to them because those individuals are
Jared, waiting. Put a pin in that for one second.
Sure.
So when you, because I mean, you guys know, I'm a litigator. I'm a personal injury lawyer. Like that just doesn't happen in my world. So when you say like you're going to go to John, like what is that? Because I'm fascinated by this. Like you have all these bad hombres. You got all these bad hombres. Right. Like how do you say okay? This is the guy.
Alleged bad hombre.
Alleged. Huh? Right. You know, this is the guy or the gal that we're going to go and say, hey, if you tell us ABC, you're going to get a better deal than you know than this person. Like, how do you make that decision?
That decision begins, though, and I can tell you, a lot of people may not know. When there is a killing, okay, and if I'm the on-duty DA or I'm the duty DA that's assigned that case, I get called right to the scene. So I will go right to the scene, oftentimes when the body's on the ground, and in those golden initial moments, okay, and by the way, law school never prepared you for any of that. But I can tell you, I mean, I've been to hundreds of crime scenes, and that process begins as you're evaluating what happened. Let's say you have a group of individuals that were involved in a gangland shooting. We start to gather the intel that the officers may have. I'm immediately looking at individuals I believe would be susceptible to talking to us or willing to talk to us. I look at their history. Have they negotiated cases out in the past? Have I had cases with this individual? Do right. I know them? Do any of the officers know them? So at that point, we're gathering intel from where to go. I would then...
Pause there. So then how's that go from your side now when Jared comes to you? Like how are...
Well, John could come to me too. I mean,
yeah, and we do. Like, and that's the thing. Like everybody, generally speaking, if all the attorneys are experienced people, everyone kind of sees the same thing. There's certain evidence that Jared sees at first that we don't see. And then there's us talking to our defendant who talked to this or knows this or that or the other. So we both know kind of the same things. At the time Jarrett's coming to me in whatever case it is, I kind of know who his witnesses are. And Jared knows who his witnesses are. So this is not always like...
Not a big surprise.
Right, like Alex's mom is the witness to this homicide. Right. A lot of these things happen in areas where it's the witnesses, the defendant, and the victim are kind of... You can kind of spin a wheel and they could all switch places pretty quickly. So we can kind of assess how good Jared's witnesses are going to be. And if Jared's witnesses are all guys that have been in and out of state prison or have generally in the United States, you can't use someone else's, a person's convictions against them in a trial. Like I can't, you're on the stand and I say, well, Eddie, you were, you know, convicted of rape last year.
Unless you're a liar, which kills your testimony.
Right. Unless there are certain case, like crimes, and certain crimes are crimson falsity, which mean crimes involving lack of truthfulness. So if...
Believe it or not, I've had a couple clients that have had some crimson falsity convictions and I've had to work around those. So I do know what that means.
So you kind of know all this stuff and you know how well, and again, some witnesses or victims or even defendants can be telling the complete and honest truth but still not be good witnesses. Some people just aren't going to play well on the stand. Some witnesses, some defendants.
I had a guy show up one time for court as a witness critical to my case. He showed up in an accused liar, showed up in a shirt that said, Harley Davidson, ride it like you stole it. But Eddie, you could appreciate, and Alex too, you guys could appreciate credibility is everything.
Absolutely.
So what do I do when I have a liar or somebody that's a convicted thief that the minute he or she comes in and says, the guy with the red shirt is sitting there and I saw him shoot the victim in this case, and then John's colleagues get up and start saying, well, you're a thief, you're a liar, you're this. I then have to rehabilitate that person. And any litigator knows that you have to do that.
Sure.
How do we do it? When you look at your case from 10,000 feet, you have to know what physical evidence, what substantiating evidence do I have to corroborate what that person's saying. So you don't sell the steak, you sell the scissor. You've got to keep building the credibility of that person. And he had a very high-profile homicide, an individual who repeatedly changed his story, was a convicted of many criminal falsity cases. The way that individual was rehabilitated was through an ad nauseum examination of the physical evidence. And you can see the jury almost nodding and understanding as we were building that person's credibility, rehabilitating that person, that the leap of faith that a jury would have to take at that point isn't as high because you have that credibility, you have that corroboration. And they'll always be, if John is doing his job, which he does, he gets a pretty good deal for his clients. And they're going to come in and say, you're lying because you got this deal.
Right.
We have to do, but look, there's only a couple of things that can be said. Your witness is a liar. He's doing that. He or she's doing this because they got a deal. All the things President Trump is saying.
Right.
So this is a defense attorney playbook and something we have to deal with.
Other than just forget the crime and falsity stuff and rehabilitating. The other thing is some people, and you've had it in civil cases, some people are just bad witnesses. You get your star witness on the stand, and that person is just a not likable person for whatever reason. It's tough.
Because I tell my clients all the time, look, be yourself. Unless yourself is an asshole.
Yeah.
If yourself is an asshole, be somebody else.
Right.
Because you're not going to be, and in my business, I mean, listen.
I've been trying to be somebody else for years.
Prepping for my jury trial starts the day I sign a client up, and I sit there and I say, you know, ultimately, are 12 men and women in state court or 8 men and women in federal court, are they ultimately going to like this person? And so that's why, you know, what fascinates me about what you guys, the work that you guys do is, generally speaking, you got none of the people are likable. I mean, you know, it, usually in
you
this
would say that, but that's not necessarily true. There are some defendants that are very sympathetic people.
I would agree with that. I've had occasion in my job to get to know a lot of John's clients and people in that situation. And there are moments, believe it or not, of levity. Because I think a lot of people...
In between the killings.
Yeah.
Well, not everything is a killing.
The truth is, the public believe, and these are conversations I have with people that aren't directly involved in the business... They believe our job is pretty easy. We walk in, we wear the white hat. When you're one of the jurors and you have occasion to sit there for, some of these trials go on for weeks. I had a trial several years ago that was 2.5 months. When a jury comes in and sits in the presence of this individual day after day, sees them interact with others, they're not killing anyone at that point in time. At least we hope not.
Yeah.
Familiarity.
Sure.
And all of a sudden, this human component.
Right.
So there's a risk. One juror. We need all 12.
Yeah.
One juror is moved by some moment. I had a juror tell me one time, do you know what I noticed in your case? Because we talked to our jurors afterwards.
Your shoes.
Besides my shoes. My shoes are not as fancy as John's. But,
well, John's got super fancy shoes.
But
we know that.
She said to me, you held the door open for your support staff when you came in and out.
We talk about this all the time. One of our good friends, Dave Pedry, our county manager, was an assistant district attorney for a long time.
On this show.
Yeah, he isn't. I'm sorry, he's not.
He's also John's boss.
He's your boss.
He is my boss. But
you just tell him that you love him.
No. It's a similar story, though. He had a jury trial and won. And again, he talked to the jurors afterward. They don't have to speak to you, but they can. And some older lady on the jury said, you know, I was watching you, and every time you stood up, you buttoned your jacket. And I thought, there's a nice young man. He would never lie to me.
Right.
So I'm going to vote for him.
Well,
and this is what I tell I have defendants that will say, this is a trial. I didn't do it. I'm going to trial. And I say, well, if you want to go to trial, we'll go to trial. But just think about it. You're putting your future in the hands of 12 people. These are not people that came from juror school. They're not professional jurors. There are 12 people in the community. So when you're walking around the street, you see those people like, ugh, who are all these people? That's your jury.
Oh, yeah.
That's your jury. And they're the people that are going to decide your fate. And they make decisions for the wacky holding the door for somebody or a bunch of jacket.
I want to jump in on that point, and because you know, you got, I do.
But humanizing the defendant is a huge job for us.
So I mean, I do a ton of research. We do a ton of focus groups. You know, we're talking to people all the time.
And we don't have that,
right?
So that's the thing you got to realize.
And here's the interesting thing. So what you guys are talking about, you know, how jurors make decisions, especially in the context of a criminal case. So there was a fascinating study that was done by Harvard about 6 or 7 years ago, and they were talking about how people assess credibility, how people decide whether that person, they like that person, they don't like that person, whether they want to speak to that person. So guess how long it takes for somebody to form that first impression?
5 seconds.
7 seconds. 7 seconds. And once a person...
I can do it in 5.
Right. Of course you can. You're a high achiever, John. Once somebody forms that first impression, it is so difficult to move them off of that impression. It's called confirmation bias. And so what happens is...
That's everywhere in life.
Exactly. Yeah. So now people start to pick and choose information that will conform to what their initial impression is. And it's amazing what you're saying. So
yeah,
I had a trial. Case went great. We got a good result, but I thought we should have gotten a better result. I have a jury consultant that I work with, and I talked to her afterwards, and she said to me, "How'd your expert do?" And I said, "You know, I thought he did okay, but I thought he could have gotten done better." And she said, "Well, her name's Catherine James." She says, "Well, where was he in the courtroom when you called him to the witness stand?" I said, "I don't have any idea." She said, "Well, what were you doing?" I said, Catherine, I have no idea what I was doing. She said, "Well, how did he walk to the witness stand?" I said, I don't know. She said, "Do you know if he like lurched or crawled?" Or I said, "He could have done cartwheels. I have no idea." She said, "How did he introduce himself to the jury? Or how did you introduce him to the jury? Did you just say, you know, Dr. So-and-so introduced yourself to the jury?" And I said, "You know, probably." She said, "Well, what was he wearing?" I'm like, "Fine, I don't know any of it." But she said, "Well, you should."
Yeah.
And she said, "Imagine if you're at a cocktail party with your wife." She said, "How many cocktail parties have you ever gone to where you've said to your wife, 'Hey, you know, my wife's name is Jen. You guys know that. Jen, introduce yourself to so-and-so.'" She said, jurors immediately start to pick up on that stuff. Mm-hmm. If you don't have enough respect for this person who's supposed to carry the day for your case. And so, you know, when you guys are talking about that first impression, first, you know, Jared, from the prosecution standpoint, you know, what are you doing to make that first impression of the defendant a bad one? And then, John, what are you doing to make that first impression a good one?
And that's so important, too. I have kids, you know, 18 and 13. But, like, I've taught them, like, when you go to school, the first day, make a really good impression, be super kind. After that, it doesn't matter because you're either the good kid who did something wrong or you're the bad kid and maybe got lucky and did something right. You can go back to the question, but I just think for us, you know, this, by the time you get to court, even if the jurors have said we can be objective, the hardest part, and we haven't talked about this and I just want to get it in, one of the hard parts for defense is there has been so much in the paper or whatever about the case before you get there. And none of it is from the defendant. It's the police story. It's this guy can accuse of this.
Facebook, Twitter, it's social media.
It's all these stories. Right? All the stories are how this guy did what he did. There is nowhere out there.
Well, some charity did it.
But there's no publicity out there for the other side by the time you get there.
As somebody who was practicing prior to social media's boom, somebody old like you.
Thank you.
Have you seen that as an uptick? Like, have you seen almost like not presumption of guilt, but more knowledge of what's going on and more kind of maybe this burden on jurors or judges? Like, if I don't rule in the prosecution's favor, this is going to be everywhere. I'm going to be dragged for it.
No. What I think, though, is it's harder for jurors to, when you're in a trial, they'll tell them, don't read the paper, don't watch the news. But now with social media, it is so much harder for jurors to stay objective. Because it's not just, I'm not going to watch the nightly news today and I'm not going to read the paper for a week. It's don't go on Twitter. Don't go on Facebook. Don't go on Instagram.
Don't look at your phone.
Yeah, because the news alerts pop up. It is so much harder for them not to see the news now. I don't think that it's harder for that. If anything, it might be a little bit easier for defense if they had a very vocal group to try to put their side out. But that's a very rare thing. And generally, from a defense point of view, you know, you have the right to remain silent. It's always the first thing we tell our clients is if you get arrested, don't talk to the police. Don't say anything. And if I talk to them and say, okay, we're going to talk to Jarrett, maybe, you know, we can do something here, then you'll do it with me there. But otherwise, don't say anything. And that's always been the push. When I was in law school, one of my professors, one of the few professors that actually practiced law, was a guy by the name of John Burkoff. And he did a lot in the criminal defense realm. And he was one of those guys that, you know, did studies on actually doing kind of PR for the defense, like getting stories out there to try to even it up in the media. So when the time people in the public see it, they go, oh, they see both sides. But that's a very rare thing. But no, I don't know that the social media has made it more skewed towards the prosecution. I just think it's everyone it's just inundated.
It's more challenging to work in that environment. Yeah. But I will say, back to your point about making that impression.
Yeah, how do you handle
it? Well, you have to think about it this way. You have 12 individuals who were ripped from their lives. Now they're going to be shown images of violently killed individuals.
Because you're going to have a defendant who's sitting there well-dressed, proper appearance.
And I always say this too. They get paid if somebody they get $9 a day. Yeah. But here's the challenge. Now, I've done death penalty cases. So everybody, and let me tell you something. Everyone says the same thing. If you hurt my son, my daughter, my wife, my family, I'll kill you, okay? You've heard people say that, or they should have the death penalty back in. It's a little bit different of an experience when you come in a highly Roman Catholic community, wearing a suit and tie, years after the crime, after they've been sitting in a room with an individual they've been looking at, with their family present, to now say, ladies and gentlemen, you've heard the evidence, now kill us.
Well, and again, right. And for the jurors that have 12 people sit around and discuss killing this guy is completely different than if you were in a dark alley and some guy attacks your wife, you may want to kill him at that moment and you may actually do it. But to like a year later to sit around with a bunch of other people going, okay, the guy attacked my wife. Should we kill him or should we not kill him? Let's talk about it.
It's very challenging.
Far less people would get killed. I mean, if the person who was accused of killing the person sat around with 11 people and discussed it for a week, they probably wouldn't have killed him either.
It's a tremendous challenge. And the reality is you're asking these lay men and women to make, of all ages, young and old, to make the decision on someone's life. And it's, I can tell you, there are cases where you need to go for it.
Yeah.
There are other cases I've been involved in four. With the ones that actually had gone to trial too. And it was personally challenging. I mean, I'm a father. I go home. I can tell you, I was writing the closing for a death penalty case while my little girl was playing at my feet. Yeah. You know, I'm not built to take life. I'm built to protect life. I'm built to seek justice for lives that have been taken. But I can tell you this. I went in and did my job. Because I felt strongly enough that this individual put himself in that situation. The Selinsky case was a death penalty case, and the Gotcha case and the murder of Luzerne County Fair Queen Harry Martin.
I just talked about the Gotcha case the other day.
Yeah, and those cases, they were death cases. So the stakes couldn't be higher, but these are individuals who committed a crime and committed these aggravating circumstances that put their own lives in jeopardy. So I believe we were justified in seeking it. And in both of those cases, the jury said we're guilty of first degree murder, but we want life in prison and not death.
And this is the other side of the question that you asked before, and I never really got a chance to answer, which, you know, people say to defense lawyers all the time, how can you defend this person?
Yeah, so
everybody has a job to do. Right. Jarrett doesn't believe in the death penalty. And I don't know if he does or doesn't, and I don't care for the purposes of this comment. Even if he doesn't, he's a lawyer. He has a job. He's an advocate. And if his boss, you know, the district attorney says, we're seeking death penalty in this case.
You gotta do your job.
He does his job and he will do it. And he may not feel good about it. He may go to confession on Sunday, but he's gonna do it.
But it's not a decision that's made lightly. I can tell you the times it's been made under different DAs I've worked for. I've had input in the decision. The families have we've had families that have come up and they didn't want that.
And for the defense, it's a job. Like that person has rights, and it's not necessarily your job to maybe have them found not guilty. It's your job to get them the best deal they can get or to get them found guilty of the things they're actually guilty of. Most cases don't go to trial. Most defendants, I'm going to say 90%, don't come in and say, I didn't do this. It wasn't me. I wasn't even there. Most of it, I'm not guilty of what they're saying I did. I wasn't dealing drugs, but I had drugs. I used drugs.
They were somebody else's.
That, no, no. They're my drugs. I just don't sell them. Like, that's most of the cases.
I just use massive quantities of.
Well, that's the thing. We talk about the change in the, in the law. Like, it's not changing the law. It's changing circumstance. People don't understand. And you guys know the opioid crisis as well as I do. People would get caught years ago with, you know, 20 bags of heroin. And grandma reads in the paper, 20 bags of heroin. Oh, my God, this person's a drug dealer. They're selling drugs all over the place. You guys both know.
That might get, that might get somebody through a half a day.
If you're a hardcore addict, you said it. That's half a day. But try to explain that to, oh, it's individually packaged. It's this and that's that. Well, of course. You don't go to Sam's Club and buy a kilo of heroin.
And that, John, that brings up a really good point now with the opioid crisis, because it is, I mean, and it's an epidemic. How are you approaching those cases, Jared, where you got people who are just, I mean, they're just hardcore addicts?
We've been fighting the drug war in many senses on opposite sides and on the same side. When John talks about we resolve these cases, oftentimes John or someone in his position will call me and say, we want this person to get treatment. You have to understand the drug market before you can make a knowing decision on behalf of your case. So
has there been a little bit of it? So has there been, since the opioid epidemic, has there been?
There's been a tremendous shift.
Like
and as a defense lawyer, I would agree with that. At one point, not long ago, within the last decade, if you were caught with enough heroin that they were charging you with a trafficking offense, intent to deliver or delivery, you were done. Like, that was it. Their treatment court wasn't an option. It's gotten to the point
where it didn't exist.
Well, even after it did, but I mean, there has come, and I don't want to say even for prosecutors, but it's their job to prosecute. They realize what a problem this is, and they realize that punishing an addict isn't necessarily the answer. I mean, at a certain point, you have no option, but treatment has become a more viable option even for the prosecution, and they are, you know, not as amenable as defense bar would like them to be, but they are certainly more amenable than they were. And treatment as a form, as opposed to prosecution or punishment, is way more prevalent now than it was 5 years ago.
And I think, too, what you're seeing, we have to, not only do we have to educate ourselves, the office, police officers involved in these prosecutions have to get educated as well. So they have to understand and recognize there are individuals using a greater degree of heroin. But then when you get into an operation that's operating out of three different houses in a town where you're dealing in thousands of dollars and lots of cutting paraphernalia and packaging, it's clearly a distribution place and those felony charges fit. But that's what's changed in the marketplace.
So I wanted to pivot and ask a question that's a little bit sensitive, but you know, from you guys, when you're looking at what's going on in the county, especially, you know, people that are going to jail, is there a racial disparity between, you know, people that are in prison in terms of African Americans, Hispanics, white? I mean, what's going on?
And this is a hot topic. People like to talk about this a lot. It's funny there, and I don't know if Jared was privy to it or involved. There is a organization called VERA, and I can't remember what VERA stands for, and I apologize to the good VERA people. Around the country, they do these sort of studies to determine are more of one gender, race, age being incarcerated. And for our purposes, we were more concerned with how long are people staying in prison, because I'm on the prison population task force where we made a concerted effort to try to keep the prison population down, because we have a very old, small prison and it got very overcrowded. So Stephanie Salavantis, myself, Steve Greenwald, the county manager, all of these people are on this panel, and we've been working on it and actually doing a really good job getting the population is way down. But we were really interested in seeing how long are people staying in jail. And then there was this whole big breakdown, and the report just came out, and I could get any of you guys a copy if you want to see it. I'm sure Eddie, you're enthralled. But
I've been waiting for that report to come out. Every day I hit refresh on my family.
But it breaks it so down exciting. By like by race, by age, by gender, by the crime, the reason they're in, and how long they stay in. And there is actually the data, at least in Luzerne County, shows that minorities will, at least, if not are incarcerated more, which I believe they are, but are also held in prison long. For instance, if a person who's not a person of color gets arrested for the same crime, they'll probably get bailed out, where the person of color will stay in prison. And the numbers kind of back that up. There are a bunch of other remarkable, and it doesn't go to race, but there's a bunch of other remarkable statistics that have come out of it. Like, females are 1.5 times more likely to violate their probation than a male. And I cannot understand that. And the other thing that we've seen, and this is not your question, but I'm sure you'll find it fascinating, the biggest change in the incarcerated person population in Luzerne County is women. Women are being incarcerated at a much higher rate than they used to be compared to men. And to the point where our...
Why you put women in jail, Jared?
Well, I think, look, there's two things. I think that's a loaded conclusion.
One is
we don't have the resources, and we're working on addressing those for the female population that we may have for the male population, which we have programs of work release and other housing that we're working on.
But more females are being incarcerated now.
I just want to know what Jared's problem with women is.
I have no problem. The bigger question is...
We're going to ask your wife.
Yes, you could ask her.
I have a problem with women.
The bigger question is the equity studies that are now being done on whether or not minorities, particularly African Americans, beyond Luzerne County are in fact being incarcerated at higher rates. So the question becomes, do African Americans commit more crimes, or are they prosecuted and jailed more harshly? And I can tell you, I was someone who was ignorant of a lot of that information early on in my career, but have taken a hard look at those things over the years. Take the crack statute.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about that. Here's something
I was going to go to that. I'm glad
you
said
the crack statute in the federal system. In large part, white powder cocaine was abused predominantly by white
businessmen.
White businessmen.
They had money.
Right. Crack was predominantly trafficked and used in a lower socioeconomic African-American community.
It was cheaper, right?
Yes. You can get caught with the same amount of crack cocaine versus powder cocaine, face a probationary sentence, slap on the wrist for the powder cocaine versus crack, you could be looking at a 5 to 10 year incarceration rate. So the reality is African-Americans were being incarcerated for the same crime, essentially, at a higher level.
Explain that to me. How did that happen? Obviously, somebody had to write that law.
Well, crack didn't exist, and then it did, and it existed in lower income communities, and it became, we have not all been practicing law forever, but we've all been alive at least, quite a while when crack first came up. You recall it was like when AIDS first happened. That's all you heard about. Oh, there's this new drug, crack, and people are in crack houses and they lost their houses and they're homeless and it's a big epidemic. And then you'd see, unfortunately on TV, you'd see the faces of crack, which middle America would see and be terrified. And then that's how laws get written, because the middle America starts complaining, we need to do something about this crack. And again, is there more crack than there is powder cocaine, or is that just the hot story on the news?
So I think there was some well-intended legislators that drafted that legislation, but I also think there was a more nefarious angle to it too, where people saw it as an opportunity to punish African Americans more harshly. And the law, thankfully, has changed, because here's the other issue. It's not as well received to fight for the rights of indigents, to fight for the rights.
I never noticed.
I bet you some of these legislators were white, older, white-haired guys.
Right. So as you see African Americans and minority groups becoming more prevalent in the defense bar, in the legislature, in Congress, these issues that were near and dear to their communities were coming to the forefront and have been in large part rectified, but many of them still exist and are being reviewed with studies like John talked about with Vera.
Short of legislature like that, for somebody like you, okay, who's enforcing laws, do you find it kind of as a burden on yourself to be knowledgeable of these statistics?
I think it's incumbent.
Did I ask that right?
I think if your question is, do I feel responsible and require that I stay up on these things and be cognizant of them? Yes, I do. And I can tell you, I have been involved in prosecutions against African-American, white, Hispanic defendants, male, female. And I can tell you, it does not factor, at least in the cases I've been a part of.
I can assure you that Jared has gone after many of my Caucasian clients. I can verify that.
Disproportional amount, wouldn't you say?
But I've learned. I mean, I grew up in Greater Pittston, which I wasn't wrestling with the issues that face African Americans. You talk about the changes that have happened, and I have to now be cognizant of those things. I'm on a commission in Harrisburg. Just last week, we were at a meeting, and we watched an equity study, and I was blown away. You know, these aren't things that we're tasked with thinking about enough. And I think that it's significant that the studies are being done. But more importantly, we see change being made.
And to Jared's point, I think Jared's right. I mean, Jared's a smart guy. Jared cares about these things. He's a prosecutor and he's passionate, but he's also compassionate. And I was just having a conversation yesterday, as a matter of fact, about, and I think there is a correlation. You're a smart guy. You care.
All right. We get it. He's smart.
570-283-182.
He's compassionate. He's good looking. I mean,
I'll be back every week. You feel it's your job to be knowledgeable about these things so you can do your job better. And I was having the conversation with someone else about a different prosecutor. And I said, there seems to be a nexus between being not very good at your job and being a hard hit. And you have seen prosecutors come and go. The prosecutors who aren't all that on the ball, who don't have the skill set Jared has, are always, almost always, the ones that want
to. Are you looking for a deal for a client right now?
I think he is.
But you know what I mean. You've seen these guys.
I'm sorry. I don't live in a vacuum. And I get worked over. I cry in closing arguments. I yell. I scream. I'm often quick to anger, quick to tears. But the reality is, we cannot forget. You know, at home, you got to go home and kiss your babies. You have to do the right thing. I mean, we're prosecuting crimes, but at the same time, we're prosecuting people. Who oftentimes, we talked about it in our last show, 90% of our crimes, and I use statistics, are drug fueled.
Yeah.
So you have to have some compassion in your heart for the challenges. Look, a lot of the people we have before us didn't have a lot of the opportunities we had at this table. Okay? You have to be cognizant of that.
That's the thing people miss. Like, it's this amorphous defendant. It's this defendant, which is why prosecutors in a trial will always say, defendant did this, defendant did that. Defense attorneys will always say, Edward Ceramboli did this, Edwards, because you have to humanize that person. Because people, I had a friend who said, and this is one of the wisest things I've ever heard this person say, it's, I'm going to run for district attorney. And my campaign, and they weren't serious either. They said, and my campaign slogan is going to be, I will put everybody in jail except your son. Because that's what it is. You hear about these crimes on TV. It's like, throw them in jail. No probation, no treatment. Jail forever. Everyone's got to go to jail forever. Then someone you know gets in trouble. Oh, why are they treating this guy like a criminal? Because he allegedly committed a crime. But once you know the person, there's a human face. You know that that person played Little League. You know that that person has a job. You know that person has a child. That's a real person. All of these defendants are real people. Some are better people than other people, and some are very good people that made really bad mistakes.
And some deserve prosecution.
Absolutely.
And don't get me wrong.
And most defense attorneys know that.
When the time comes, it's a knee-jerk reaction sometimes, but as time comes, some people you've got to drop the hammer. And it's that simple. But you cannot treat, every case gets treated differently, I have to say. It has to be right by case basis. That's a human being. It's a person. You've got to understand what they did, who they are, and what is the best way to approach that.
And to your point, and this goes back to what you said earlier, the question about race, and we got into the whole crack cocaine versus powder cocaine. Treating each case individually is important. That's why we have judges who are independent. They're not prosecutors. They're not defense lawyers. They're independent hearers of the law and the fact in some cases. And it's their job to be judicious and fair. part of the problem with laws is we had these, you know, three strikes rules, these mandatory minimums.
Yeah.
What takes the job of a judge out of the hands of a judge more than a mandatory sentence? Well, I have no discretion here. I have to give you this 5-year sentence in a drug case. And again, it goes by weight. So if you have lived like a Boy Scout your entire life and at one point got caught with 2 grams of cocaine, you're going to jail for a year. If you've been committing crimes your entire life, and you're caught with 2 grams of cocaine, you go to jail for a year. Basically, there's some factors in there. But that's not right. There's no way that that should be the same. Everybody's an individual. Everybody's different.
And every case should be treated right. You talk about another check on the system. Many of John and I and Alex, and you've been doing this long enough, our colleagues have been, several of them have been elected or promoted to the bench.
Sure.
Some of them, Judge Thorosky was a career public defender. Judge Lucas was my boss at one point, was district attorney. Judge Hughes, Judge Bowe came from the district attorney's office. So you would think, do they have that lean? Once they put on that role, and I can tell you those individuals I just mentioned, call it straight.
Yeah.
They don't see the world the way they did maybe when they were in. And all of those individuals were, and Judge Gartley, same thing. These are individuals that came from the district attorney's or PD's office. And oftentimes, I'm encouraged by, I could see Judge Lucas make a decision that maybe goes against the DA's office and say, wow, he's really calling it straight. Or,
right.
Or Judge Sklarowski will give a public defender a hard time. And I say, he's holding their feet to the fire because he's seeing it from the.
And it happens all the time. I Judge Sklarowski, great guy. We took the LSATs sitting next to each other. We interned at the public defender's office together.
So he's old too?
Unfortunately, he is. I'm sorry, Judge Sklarowski. But I've had some clients in front of him that he's buried. I had a case I worked out with one of the ADAs. It was one of those. He had a sympathetic defendant and a not-so-sympathetic victim. Because of that, the district attorney, I worked it out. We had kind of an agreed-upon deal. But based upon the facts, the judge looked at it and said, I'm not going with that. I'm doing this, and kind of buried my guy. Now, and it's a defense lawyer is the judge, and he's a guy I've known forever. Still do that. Judge Vogue was in the DA's office, career prosecutor, basically. You know, he has a few policies. And I remember having a younger African-American female with a drug case in front of him. And he had this policy. If you have whatever it was, you're going to jail. Meanwhile, this woman would, you know, turned her life around, was working, had children, had been out for like a year from the time she was arrested, never arrested before or against. I put all that on the record at the time of sentencing. You know, this is my policy. But given what I'm hearing, you deserve a break and get home confinement. If you mess up home confinement, I'm going to bury you under the prison. I don't know if he actually said that, but. And that's, again, to your point, they're judges. They may have a particular meaning in their lives, but they have a job to do, much like prosecutors and defense lawyers have a job to do. And for the most part, they do it, and I'm kind of proud of our criminal bench.
Well, and I think we have a very good
criminal. I agree.
That these are, as I said, no case is a number, and it's significant who that individual is, who their victim is, who the affiant is oftentimes, or what is the charge. But these are, everyone is taking the time. The system has enough processes in place where you can consider all of those things in fashioning a result. Because as John said, these cases don't become Perry Mason trial.
Right.
Oftentimes they're resolved, you know, in John's office or in the courtroom shortly before we go forward. We enter into some kind of an agreement because we consider all of those factors.
I kind of, one thing you said, John, I kind of take issue with, and maybe it's easy for me to take issue with as a non-criminal lawyer, but when you mentioned, you know, you have the two guys who get arrested for cocaine, one's had a bunch of crimes and one's been a Boy Scout his whole life. When we hear stories about like this kid who's the swimmer who gets arrested for rape and, you know, the judge essentially says, I don't want to mess up your life. I'm going to give you your house arrest or whatever it was at that time. We're giving deference to these people who have had privileged lives and been able to get away from trouble. So what are we doing? How do we combat that?
That example is,
it's actually a very, very,
no, but it actually makes my point. Because that's a guy who's convicted of a rape and gets out and gets probation. A person who's convicted of rape should be treated like any other person who's convicted of a rape. And there are certain guidelines you get. So I don't know. And again, that was not in Pennsylvania, so I don't know what the guidelines are. In Pennsylvania, if you're convicted of a crime, there are sentencing guidelines. So in Pennsylvania, you get a minimum and a maximum, not to be law school here. But the judge knows, based on the person's prior record and the gravity, how bad the crime is, you go to a matrix, your minimum sentence has to be somewhere in this range without real extreme circumstances. So to go outside of, you should be in there. So I don't know how in a rape probation is even in the guidelines. That seems like an anomaly. But
sometimes the justice system gets it wrong. And I want to, we've been going for about an hour. I want to kind of bring this in for a landing, but I want to put you guys on the spot.
Oh boy.
Oh, I'm going to put you both on the spot now. Because
do I like John? Yeah, I guess.
Well, I mean, you guys have had a love fest this whole time. It's, you know, whatever criminal, you know, client John has right now is getting a great deal. But
you know. I have two guys I have to work out, neither one of them are Jared.
Maybe you have two cases.
You know, I said, Alex brings up a great point. Sometimes the criminal justice system gets it wrong. It's not always perfect. Sometimes it gets it wrong. We have safeguards. We've been talking about them, but you know, every time I go and talk to people about the law, people always want to know what I think about O.J. Simpson. It is always.
Are you following him on Twitter now?
So, and then was O.J. guilty? Wasn't he guilty? And so I want to ask, you know, I got a prosecutor and a defense lawyer, and I want to ask you guys, first from prosecution standpoint, what do you think? And then John, from the defense standpoint, what do you think? And then I will give you my little take on it, what I think.
Well, first point, I answer your question with a question. How's his hunt for the real killers going? Here's the thing. O.J. Simpson was 100% guilty of killing Ronald Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson. That was a miscarriage of justice. That became, and look, we have to put on, I don't want to say a performance. We have to keep people engaged in prosecution, okay? That's important. That became an absolute 10-ring circus.
Absolutely.
O.J. Simpson spun societal problems to his benefit, built in a defense, and was acquitted. Okay? It was, and I know individuals that were involved in that case, individuals that have reviewed the evidence. We've utilized them in our own presentations. I can say, based on my review of the evidence of the O.J. Simpson case, my understanding of it, he's 100% he committed this.
Okay. Put a pin in that for a second. John, what do you think?
Well, I would say, based on what I have seen, I think it's more likely than not he probably killed those two people. But I still go back to my earlier point from the beginning that guilt, or not innocence, but not guilt, is a legal question, which depends on the performance. And this is what we talked about before. How do you represent these people? Everyone has a job to do. And the theory about this system is if both parties do their job, the right outcome will come. And I think in this case...
Stay on that for a second about the job. Because I want to ask you this. You have prosecutors and you have defense attorneys who are supposed to be doing their job. What do you think was the single biggest piece of evidence in the O.J. trial that led to him being found not guilty? Pick one. Just pick one.
As far as impact goes, I can say the glove.
The glove.
Race.
The race. So the prosecutor says race. The defense lawyer says the glove. So they interviewed all of the jurors afterwards. You know what every single solitary juror said was the single biggest piece of evidence? The glove.
This is what the defense lawyers know.
Now, you know how the guy, you know, so when we talk about lawyers doing their job, you know how the glove got on his hand?
Yes.
Yeah. Chris Darden might have put it on.
But
the prosecutor.
This is put it on. And this is the thing that's interesting about this case, because and I said in the beginning, when you ask about just being guaranteed a lawyer, the weight, generally speaking, in a criminal case, all of the resources and all of the manpower is behind the prosecution coming down on this person. And again, even in our county, which is not a big county, there are 20-some lawyers, there are 10 detectives, all of the police forces, all of this.
They're not on every one of my cases.
No, no. And all that you don't need. Right. And all of the money. And generally, there's maybe a defense lawyer, maybe one investigator. Right. That was one of the few cases where the cards were stacked against the prosecution. And no offense to anybody in that case.
I think
O.J. Simpson had better lawyers than the state of California.
I disagree. I completely disagree. And then here's, I'll give you mine, because
They asked all the jurors afterwards.
Hey, that assumes they're being honest. If they correct. Truly felt, let's talk about this.
Yeah, they're not going to say, well, I didn't, well, I wouldn't vote. I wouldn't say guilty because he's black.
They're not going to say that. Mark Furman, for example, you talk about where race factored in with Mark.
It did. Okay? But what does the glove do? Him putting the glove on in a case where now you've got good lawyers on both sides. So what do they have? Reasonable doubt. That's it. Right. So him putting the glove on and it doesn't fit. Now you just need one person in that jury deliberation room.
Absolutely.
And every single solitary juror, they said, if he never puts the glove on, you convict him. They said, absolutely.
But that's a big attorney mistake. You, like, that's the oldest.
So that's
never,
guy, right.
Never ask a question you don't know the answer to.
And that's true.
Don't
that's
have him put on the glove if you don't, and it's not going to fit
on
the rubber glove anyway.
We all know that there are occasions where you've got to ask a question where you don't know the answer. You just need to be prepared. For whatever the answer.
But that question shouldn't be try on this clothing.
No.
I mean,
no.
I don't know. You got a wet glove, wet leather glove that's sitting in a box.
Over a rubber glove.
Over a rubber glove.
Plus, for what, 3 years?
I mean, did anybody?
Plus, how easily manipulated is that?
Oh.
He's putting it on. He could pull it halfway and go, oh, it's not going on.
Yeah, I mean.
I can do that with a glove that fits me right now without a rubber glove. Like.
It's
you're putting it in the defendant's
no doubt
literally putting
powerful,
it in the defendant's hand.
A powerful piece of evidence for O.J. Simpson. And I agree. I am sure it factored in. However, so much of that case was about things beyond what happened in the court that night.
No doubt.
And if you look, just look at the blood evidence there. How they put the case on trial and who was planting. Well, let me say this.
Let me ask you as a prosecutor. You're ever going to ask a defendant to put a glove on in the middle of a courtroom without knowing 100% that glove fits his damn hand?
Unequivocally, I would not ask anybody to try on a glove.
Right.
But I can tell you, when you look at, to believe the frame job, okay, which would have begun seconds after the discovery of the body.
Right.
O.J. Simpson is a man who traveled regularly. You would have to know he was in town, had the opportunity, all those things. Somebody who committed that crime would have had to have been in the police department. Okay, this is the craziness.
He did. Listen, I firmly believe.
So take it to its furthest end. I just think that there was so much going on there, and we could do an episode.
Let me ask you a different question. You believe he did? Do you believe he should have been convicted?
Yes. In that? No.
In that trial.
I believe there were factors, things that happened in that trial that I could see the jury going the other way.
Right.
However, that wasn't your question.
That was my question.
Right. Yeah. So it dovetails into.
You just asked a question, you don't know the answer.
I say it dovetails into.
No, I kind of knew.
If you're doing your job,
honest.
You know, and everybody always asks, like, what happened? How did the jury get it wrong? And I don't necessarily know or believe that the jury got it wrong in that trial based upon what the prosecutors were doing in doing their job.
Here's another question. Everybody asks this question. What if you convicted somebody that's not? You know, how do you live with that? How do you go forward? And we go back to that process, those checks and balances along the way. You know, I don't believe that that's happened in any case I've prosecuted.
Right.
I don't know that it's happened in any case I'm familiar with, as we've gone through the years at the DA's office.
But I would rather let 100 guilty people go free than convict one innocent person.
Right. But I can tell you, it's something we take very seriously as prosecutors. We review the. We're part of the case from word go, as I said. And as we proceed, we build a case. I've said no on the decision whether or not to charge, knowing that a person may have committed the crime, but also tasked with the requirement I got to prove.
Right. You were mentioning earlier, and this is related, the changing of criminal law in Luzerne County. One of the areas, and I don't know if you agree with me or not, I'm interested to know, one of the areas I see growing lately. Is, and again, we're going to have to explain this, the PCRAs, Post-Conviction Relief Act, they are on the upswing. When you hear in the paper or on TV, someone was convicted years ago, like the making a murderer thing, and right. Looking for a new, they always say they're appealing their conviction, looking for a new trial. Generally, what they're talking about is they're once you've been convicted, it's not an actual appeal. An appeal is saying there were errors of law. Post-conviction is you're saying my trial was not fair, either my lawyer was ineffective or they ignored the evidence or there's new evidence and I want a new trial. That is booming. Like
my department, Conflict Counsel, does all of them now. We just agreed to do them all. And they are growing, which is the Gotcha case. Jared and I had Gotcha, one of Gotcha's PCRAs, and I've had them for several people. And that's one of the areas where there are more and more and more I see. Either people are more just not happy, or they're more litigious. And this education within society, they know it exists, so they're all filing them. But there are a lot of them. And some of them are valid, and some of them are not. And going back to the other, how do you represent some people? I had one just 4 years ago that was a man, I'm not going to say names, was convicted of raping his 5-year-old daughter and was doing like 20 to 40 years in prison. So I get assigned this case as conflict counsel to do this PCRA, which I am not thrilled about because that's the case nobody wants to touch. But I'm going to do my job. The guy calls me or sends me a letter and he says, first thing I have to know is, do you think I'm not guilty? Because if you don't think I'm not guilty, I don't want you to do my case. And what I had said to him is, I don't know if you did it or not, and I don't care. That's not my job. My job is to present your case, and I'm going to present your case just as vigorously and just as effectively, whether you in fact did it or did not do it. And the last thing I'm going to do is ask you if you did. And it turns out that was a long process. It was a horrible, horrible fact pattern, horrible case. There were multiple supplemental PCRAs filed. Eventually, I ended up winning and getting the guy a new trial. District Attorney's Office appealed the decision to give him a new trial, and I didn't do the appeal myself. I did the PCRA, but ended up being that the Superior Court said, no, the PCRA wasn't filed correctly. So this guy who's now serving 20 to 40 for something horrible that he's having trouble living with was going to get a new trial. Now the Superior Court said, no.
So you're not. For the merits.
No, we did not. I mean, and that was a case where the victim actually now, years later, actually came in during, I had a medical expert come in and dispute the medical testimony at trial. Trial counsel did not put on a medical expert, which was part of my PCRA. So she came in and mentioned everything that they did wrong. And then secondly, the victim, and perhaps most importantly, now as a teenager or young adult, came in and said it didn't happen, which think was obviously the biggest thing. Which is a bigger problem because now this guy's still serving 20 to 40 and the victim's saying it didn't happen.
Wow.
And look, I think without getting into the merits of that, I'm not familiar with that particular case, but I can tell you, I think the obligation to sum up the dynamic, the interplay between John and the job he has to do and the job I have to do is that we have to do justice. We have to do justice for his client, my clients, the victims, society, the state. But we have to do justice for everyone involved. Because if the system fails at any level, if John's people aren't doing their job, then the system isn't operating fairly, it's not operating properly. And if I'm not doing my job properly, I mean, my job isn't to win. My job isn't to lock people up for as long as we can. There are people that deserve it, as I said. Our job is to find a just disposition of the case. That's the way I look at it. I think John would agree. That's the way
absolutely.
He looks.
Absolutely. People ask all the time, how do you defend people? They're not all looking to say I didn't do it. They're just saying, I want a fair deal. I want to be held accountable for, albeit accountable for what I did, but not what they're saying I did. And if they are convicted, they want something reasonable, not having the book thrown at them. And again, I'll admit, some people do deserve to have the book thrown at them. Some do not. And if you treat them all the same, then that's a problem. I think that, and to your point, I just want to throw this quick plug in. The staff I have, the attorneys I have at Conflict Counsel are all great. They do phenomenal work. They are passionate. We just had, there was a not a DA case, an attorney general case, huge drug case that one of my attorneys successfully argued a suppression, and it's going to turn into a big thing. All of this wiretap evidence is going to be thrown out now. And it's just because of their diligence and hard work and not giving up. And I'm really, really proud of those folks and couldn't do it without them. They handle a heavy burden and they're just, like you said, they're passionate people.
You're quite unified. I've had the entire, office after me. I've had cases where they bring their spouses
in. I'm sure it was well-deserved, Jerry.
They talk, to your point earlier, people give a bad rep to public defenders. So they don't care. They're just, any of my people phoning it in, Jared? They will, whether they're right or wrong, they're going to bust your chops.
And I can speak to the DAs that we have. you cannot, this is a job, you can't leave at the office. I've done permanent damage internally because of this job.
It's not a 9-to-5 job.
You cannot leave it. You take it with you. You take it home with you. You take it into everything you do, but I think you grow professionally and personally if you have a stomach for this kind of work, which John certainly does. John, you've been an amazing guest. We're going to do a show. I'm fascinated with OJ and Casey Anthony and Natalie Holloway. Yeah. We're going to do shows on that.
Well, OJ be on TV talking about
it. We talk about how old I am. OJ was near and dear to my heart, the case, because that was all happening while I was in law school.
Right.
I was in sixth grade, John.
I was in Pittsburgh, and we had court TV there before it was anywhere else. Yeah. So we were 24/7 OJ at that time. I remember watching the Bronco going down. So that's near and dear. But thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, this is fun.
Again, I didn't do it in the beginning. John Hakeem, I've been practicing for 25 years. Again, to me being old, I've had a private criminal practice for 19 years. I've been a part-time public defender, part-time conflict counsel. Now the attorney administrator of the Department of Conflict Counsel, which I created in 2014 in Luzerne County. And
your cigar and shoe enthusiast.
Oh,
and
shoes. Yeah. How many pairs of shoes do you have?
I, at the advice of my attorney, refused to answer.
You're going
to
take the fifth on that?
But I also want, again, and I know it's your job, but I want to thank the guy at the Best Cigar, Best Cigar Pop. This is if you're in Drums or in Southern Luzerne County, there's no other place to go. They open, they plug for them, they open December 9th at the pub.
And this guy, this is good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, this is a lot of fun. I want to thank Alex for, coming with me today.
I won't be back because I'm just not leaving.
You have to leave to be back.
Yeah. Well, thank you again, John. Thank you. This is, for me, being able to kind of almost interview you and Jared was a lot of fun because I don't do criminal work, and just being able to understand a little bit more the complexities of it.
How many years is it that you would have a civil client that had a criminal problem, you would call me like,
right.
Yeah, wow, like, what is this? Yeah. And I would do the same with civil clients. I dabbled, but I certainly am not Fellerman and Saramboli. I do not have the chops you guys have.
Thank you very much. So
there's your plug.
There you go. And
I owed him one.
With that, we're going to bring this thing in for a landing again.
Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. Jared, any last words?
Just everybody have a safe weekend, and we'll see everybody soon.
Alex, anything to add?
I got to go sous vide a turkey, so I think that's about it.